I'm speaking with Farnaz Fasihi. She's a Wall Street Journal Middle East correspondent who lived in Iraq for quite a few years right after the war, and now she's stationed in Beirut and covering Middle East. I'm talking to Farnaz from her home in Beirut. Welcome to the show, Farnaz.
Hi, Gudar. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with maybe a little bit background of yourself. I know you are some sort of local. You graduated from Lake Oswego High School and went into journalism. And do you come back to Portland anytime, or have you been here recently?
Not as often as I like to, and not as often as my relatives in Portland like to. Every couple of years I make it to Portland. I still have two aunts who live in Portland and some friends, and I come to visit them, but my parents are no longer there, so I come less often. But I grew up in Portland, so it's a dear place to me.
Interesting. And how long did you stay in Iraq?
I was in Iraq for a total of 3 years. I started covering Iraq before the war, about 4 or 5 months before the war, and I even went to Baghdad when Saddam Hussein was still in power. Uh-huh. And then 3 months before the war, I crossed the border into Iraqi Kurdistan from Iran, from the Kurdish territories, illegally actually crossed the border, and stationed myself in northern Iraq and waited for the war to start, and then made my way down. As each city fell to the Americans, I made my way down south to Baghdad and was there until recently. I left late December.
Were you embedded with military forces, or you went on your own?
No, I covered the war independently. I was not embedded during the war. From time to time, I did some embeds, short embeds, a few weeks here and there with both the American military and with the British troops, and sometimes even with the State Department during various Iraqi elections or the referendum. Sometimes embedding was the only way that we could safely get to a place or find out what was going on. But for the most part, the majority of the time I was in Iraq, I was an independent journalist.
Being an Iranian, was it any advantage for you to be able to connect to the locals in Iraq, or did you get any preferred position because of your connections with probably the people who
actually worship? It was a huge asset, Gudar. Being Iranian was a huge asset in Iraq because the Iraqis, the general public, kind of saw me as different from the other mainstream, maybe your average American or Western correspondent. They felt like they could relate to me, that I was from a country next door, and I understood what was, their suffering, because my country had also been through a revolution, through war, through sanctions. So they felt like they could relate to me a lot more, and it opened a lot of doors, particularly with the Shia population and with the Kurdish population. Being Iranian was an immediate icebreaker. Many of them spoke Farsi. Many of the Iraqi clerics, many of the Kurdish Peshmerga spoke Farsi. Most of the officials, Kurdish and Shia officials in Iraq, speak Farsi. And even among the Sunnis, I was, I understood their traditions. I'm Muslim. I'm from the Middle East, so it was a big help.
Tell me. I guess after a while. We were reading your pieces in Wall Street Journal, just reporting, and then at some point you had a personal account of the situation. It was around 2004, and I think you mentioned in that email that was sent to some of your friends and then got publicity, and I remember even Oregonian here wrote a piece about it, somehow criticizing you as kind of importing your personal opinion into your reportage, so to speak. But in reality, I guess you felt personally affected by what was happening around you. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure, Gudaz. The thing about the email and the criticism that came my way was I think unfounded, because that email was not a published piece of journalism for the newspaper. It was a private correspondence between me and my friends, and it got widely circulated. And of course, it had my opinions, but no one could fault me for having opinions. I'm a human being, and no one could fault me for sharing my opinions privately with my friends. The fact that it was widely circulated, was irrelevant to the pieces that I had published. The pieces that got published in the Wall Street Journal as a professional journalist were, objective as one could professionally be, and were not opinion pieces. They were reported journalistic, articles. So that's what I have to say in defense of that email. As far as how it's impossible not to be affected by what's happening around you, particularly the Iraq war has been very unique, because journalists that they're usually between any conflict or any situation, you are seen as somewhat of an independent observer, that there's kind of a wall, invisible wall that separates journalists from the story. In Iraq, that wall completely vanished, because they were kidnapping journalists, they were killing us, they were targeting our hotels, mortaring our hotels. So we were suddenly very much a target and part of the story. So of course it became very challenging to not be influenced. Aside from that, every single day you're interviewing Iraqis, you're dealing with your local staff and kind of watching their lives unfold, you're watching the misery they're going through, and naturally you get... it touches you.
But I'm kind of interested in your personal account of the process of the war mm-hmm. itself. I mean, when you went there 3-4 months before war started and kind of found your way through down to Baghdad, and as you mentioned, you were there even during this Saddam Hussein being in power.
Saddam.
Yeah, but how? I mean, what could you identify as a turning point in the process of occupation that everything went kind of haywire? People were, I mean, at least the administration here in the U.S. was portraying the war to being a very short and clean process, but at some point it just turned around and then went totally out of their control.
I think it was things were brewing from the beginning. Certainly, from the time, the war has never really ended in the minds of the American soldiers who are there, and in the minds of certainly Iraqis who are getting killed by the dozen every day. The war is still very much ongoing 3 years on. I think a crucial turning point in terms of the insurgency getting out of hand and kind of, the Americans there going, oh my God, what's going on, was in April of 2004, where what they call a dual front opened up. Until then, it was mostly the Sunnis who were fighting the Americans, and there were some skirmishes in Fallujah, but then Sadr City, which is mostly Muqtada Sadr's Mahdi army, that became a battlefield for about a month, and I think that was a turning point, and things just went, it was down the slippery slope from then on.
I'd like to kind of get your opinion on like what is happening right now and the factions that are taking power and this fighting within the parliament in Iraq, and how do you see it developing? Is it really going to turn into a civil war the way everybody is afraid of, or it's the way the administration, the U.S. administration, is trying to portray it, as it's not as the magnitude is much less than what we hear?
I think that you could say that there is a serious problem in terms of civil and sectarian conflict in Iraq right now. And it depends on whether the government can get its act together and formulate and have a unity government that not only represents everybody but also can take everybody, all the sides, Sunni, Kurdish, Shia, into account. What the signs are not very encouraging. A couple of months after elections, they still haven't named the government. They're publicly fighting over who's going to be the prime minister. Even factions within the Shias can't agree on what to do. The Sunnis have boycotted the process. right now and won't even come and negotiate. So the political process, as important as it is, right now doesn't sound like it has the unity and the oomph to be able to quell the insurgency. What may happen in a couple of months, I can only hope that things will get better. In terms of the conflict, I can only tell you, I can point out to an anecdote. The day my own staff, who are Sunni, I called them a few days, just 2 days after the Samarra bombing, to find out what was happening, because they live in a mixed Shia Sunni neighborhood, and they told me that they've lived in that neighborhood for 20 years. They're a Sunni family. They know everybody, but they said they attacked the Shia militia in the neighborhood, attacked three Sunni mosques. They came to their door and said, get out of the neighborhood or we'll kill you. And they had to flee their own home because they were afraid of their Shia neighbors, a Sunni family. And likewise, in Shia neighborhoods where the Sunnis were attacking them. And I think when you get to the level that even mosques aren't sacred and you're burning down each other's mosques, then I don't really know where you go from there.
When was the last time you were in Baghdad or in Iraq generally?
I left Iraq on December 18th.
Oh, this past year.
Just past year, right? But
yeah. What role do
we still have a bureau there? And we have Iraqi staff that I speak to often, and I email often, and I have a lot of colleagues who are there, other journalists. So I'm in touch with what's going on, and I have Iraqi friends I speak with.
What role does Kurdish administration play? I mean, and the whole faction, because they are, most of them are Sunnis, and at the same time they were with Shiites in the process of the war and against the former regime of Iraq. But right now, are they playing a catalyzer between the forces, or I mean, what's going on?
I think they have tried very hard to be a catalyst between the Shias. The Kurds have been a catalyst between the Shias, and the Sunnis. There are some, the Kurds have an interesting position because there's some things that they can identify with the Sunnis more. For example, they're very concerned about the kind of Islamic nature of the government of Iraq, and the Shia Islamists. Political parties gaining so much power and the kind of Iran's influence. I think the Kurds are very, they have to share the same concerns as the Sunnis. On the other hand, the Kurds are a lot more pro-American and in favor of the American troops extending their stay. So in that sense, they can relate more to the Shias rather than the Sunnis and this political process moving forward. So they kind of have both, eggs in both baskets, and they have really been kingmakers. And of course, they're very interested in maintaining their autonomy in the north and keeping the semi-independent Kurdish region.
I want to ask you one question about the U.S. forces and what political role? Who is really in charge of Americans in Iraq? Is it Zalmay Khalilzad? And how does he play in this whole game?
Zalmay Khalilzad has been very proactive and publicly vocal about his role politically, much more so than any other American ambassador or American diplomat in Iraq thus far. He's, in terms of the writing of the constitution and the elections and now forming of the government, he's been meeting with everybody, trying to push the process ahead, and has not been shy about, publicly saying what the U.S. favors or what needs to be done. So he does have a very hands-on, proactive approach that's unusual for U.S. diplomats in Iraq. And I think that that's needed. I think it's been helpful for Iraqi politicians. But in terms of the military, I mean, you have the American military is of course under the guidance of the generals, not the embassy.
Did you have, while you were there, did you have much contact with military forces and GIs? And I mean, there are some polls out that about, I don't know, the majority, close to 80% of the folks over there are no more want to stay there, and they are kind of expecting to be pulled out as soon as possible. What was your impression of...
Yeah, my impression and the interaction that I had with most of the Americans, I was in contact with the, you know, day-to-day you're in touch with the American soldiers, because every time you're at checkpoints or I wanted to enter what they call the green zone, which is where most of the government official press conferences or news events happened, you know, the people at the checkpoints, the people you're in touch with are American soldiers. Most of them are very, very young, in their early 20s. Most of them don't see Iraq as their conflict, and most of them just want to come back home. And, you know, it's very risky for them. They can get blown to pieces at any given moment, and they realize that, and they don't see an end in sight, and they don't see the situation getting any better there. So when you talk to them, they're counting the days to come back home.
And I mean, do they have any purpose for that? I guess that's another question. Do they understand why they are there, and the mission accomplished statement, does it make any sense for them?
I don't think if you're a soldier in Iraq, you necessarily feel like the mission's been completely accomplished. I think they understand it's a long process ahead, and you know, I think individually they probably want to just go back home. You know, it's tough for them too. It's a strange country. It's very violent. They're very far away from anything that's vaguely familiar. And they're very, very young.
Yeah.
You know? And they're seeing, like, their friends and their fellow combat, you know, colleagues get, you know, get killed, get blown to pieces every day. It's not easy.
Yeah. Let's switch a little bit to the new situation that is brewing there. Do you feel that there is any plan of, like, because there are these rumors here, or speculation, I should say, that the purpose of probably taking out the troops from Iraq might be to prepare for attacking Iran or getting engaged in that country. Do you have anything to say on that?
I can't really say. My guess would be that would be very unlikely for a military attack on Iran, because the troops are already so stretched thin in Iraq, and I don't think there's much international or even domestic support for another war after what's happened in Iraq. That would be my intelligent guess.
What is your opinion on the claim that, for example, I mean, we hear that a lot, especially from the hawkish part of the administration, which mm-hmm. basically the majority, but that Iranian government influences these insurgencies or brings kind of fuel to the fire. And mm-hmm. have you seen any indication of that to happen?
You know, Gudaz, more than inflaming the insurgency, I mean, there are reports, the American military and the British military put out reports about how, you know, they have found arms being smuggled. These are things that the military says. I haven't personally seen any evidence of Iran supporting the insurgency, but what I have seen from time and time again in the past 3 years is Iran's subtle influence politically and socially in Iraq. Which is a lot more stronger and a lot more lasting than sending for arms, for example. I mean, Iranians, especially with the Shias and also with the Kurds, you know, you have Iranian merchants and businessmen doing trade with Kurdish partners from dispatching goods all over Iraq. You've got with the Shias, you have, you know, reconstruction firms coming to Shia towns and taking some of the load off that. You have Iran giving electricity to neighboring towns. You have, you know, media channels, television channels being set up with the help of Iranians. So there's a lot of that kind of influence going on.
Yesterday was the International Women's Day, and mm-hmm. it's also the question of what is the situation of women in Iraq 3 years after the war. And I'd like to get your opinion, based on your contact with people and women. I mean, Iraq was a secular country with all standards before the war, mm-hmm. and it's moving more toward a semi-religious society.
Absolutely, what is the, especially when it comes to women.
Yeah, what's the situation of women there?
In terms of what's happening with women's rights, I think that Iraq has regressed significantly since the days of Saddam Hussein. Before the war, Iraq had one of the most secular and progressive family laws in its constitution. Women had equal inheritance. They had they could get child custody. They had equal rights after divorce. There are a lot of things that are not necessarily the case in other Arab worlds, and that's been written into law since 1954. I did a big story about that. The dominance of the Shia Islamic parties unfortunately reversed that, and the new constitution that was passed last August changed the family law and made it based on Sharia, which is, significant loss of rights for women in terms of child custody, in terms of divorce, and in terms of, what they're able to do, in terms of men being allowed to take more than one wife without the first wife's permission. Now, if a husband wants to divorce his wife, all he has to do is go to a cleric. He doesn't even have to go to civil court, whereas before he had to go to civil court and present evidence and say why and divide his assets. So when you talk to women activists in Iraq and you talk to educated women, and they are up in arms and really angry about this.
But do you see a kind of like a movement within the society of like the women activists in Iraq organizing and trying to push on their own agenda and will? Close to what we see, for example, in Iran.
Because of safety, they can't. They have been, but because Iraq is so violent, it's so dangerous, and they're at such risk that they can't really stage protests because, you could get attacked by the Shia militia or the Islamists or have a car bomb, or you could get kidnapped. I mean, these activists can't really be very show their face because they could get assassinated. So I think the violence is also impacting what the seculars activists, especially those with women rights, how vocal they can be and how much they can bring attention to the situation. Now you go out to Iraq, you can hardly see a woman that's uncovered. I mean, when I went to Baghdad under Saddam Hussein, women were dressed nicely. You could hardly see a woman in a scarf in Baghdad. Everyone, they weren't wearing hijab. They were dressed in Western clothes. They had makeup on. And now, if you go out into Baghdad street, maybe you will see two or three mm-hmm. women without the hijab. And a lot of that is because of safety, because there's so many random kidnappings, there's so much violence, there's so much assassinations that women just kind of want to be covered up and incognito.
Well, I'm getting close to the end of the time that I allocated, and I would like to hear your maybe final words, or if you want to close the interview with anything that you think it's useful for our audience, for your former Portlanders.
I recently had a piece on the Saturday Journal about my time in Iraq and kind of, trying to... I lived there for 3 years in a war zone and tried to have as normal of a life as I could. And I had a lot of, Iraqi friends. There were a lot of people who touched my life and made it possible for me to work there, particularly our very brave and courageous Iraqi staff, without whom it would have been impossible to keep the bureau running and do our job. So there are a lot of people there who are very inspiring and very brave, and I can only hope that things get better there. But I kind of closed that piece by saying that, when I left the day that I left at the airport, my translator told me they can take you out of Iraq, but they can't take Iraq out of you. And I think that's true.